This podcast of Left, Right, and Center is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's go!
Bush to Shiites, can't you guys get along? Plus, Chuck Hagel breaks ranks, Pat Robertson goes wild, and what's the deal with gas prices? Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for Fortune magazine and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, holding down the center here on Left, Right, and Center. Joining me on the left side of our Santa Monica studio and the political spectrum is Robert Scheer, a syndicated columnist based at the L.A. Times. On the right from Washington, as always, is Tony Blankley, editorial page editor and columnist for the Washington Times. And here with us in Santa Monica and in the fourth dimension of political time and space is Arianna Huffington, editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. Welcome all from across the country and across the political spectrum. Another busy week. This was the week the Iraqi Constitution was due, and George Bush taking a break from his vacation sojourn in Idaho, I guess. He was off in Idaho to escape Cindy Sheehan and the folks there, or to make a speech, I guess, to put it more accurately, I suppose, the White House would say, to call actually one of the senior Shiite leaders trying to help resolve an impasse in terms of the Constitution that is reaching its supposedly its final hours in terms of being submitted and negotiated, et cetera. Tony Blank, I know you've been watching all this. What did it mean to have Bush call? This would be like what? Somebody calling Ben Franklin back in 1770, to use our imperfect American analogies, to call to weigh in, to try and urge someone to the table? In seriousness, how do you make of the significance of this and where this whole process stands?
Well, it's hard to tell whether the constitutional debate going on is the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end. Is this close to an agreement that will move the process forward, or are we on the precipice of the breakdown of the agreement? I don't have a clue which one we're at. The fact that the president is calling, and not only calling, but calling below the senior leadership level, working, if you will, the Iraqi provisional government as he might Congress, calling the congressman or senator trying to get a vote, is certainly an example of leadership. Whether leadership is going to accomplish its objective very much remains to be seen. So I don't have any special insight. It's very hard not being on the scene to know where it's going. I do sense that we are at a moment when either the political process is going to break down or it's going to move forward.
I'm sure we've got more special insight here, even at 12,000 miles distance. But let me say, Bob Scheer, and also, can I note to listeners, you're playing with pain today, and we admire that, and we admire your carrying on after coming to the studio straight from the dentist.
Matt, trust me, the pain I feel from the dentist is nothing like what I feel from Bush's floundering on this issue.
That's excellent. That's like Bill Clinton's argument in 92. What they're throwing at me is nothing compared to what you're taking. Go ahead.
It's amusing in that it's pathetic, but the consequences, I think, are enormous. This guy has managed to make Saddam Hussein look good to a number of Iraqis. Amazingly enough, there was a demonstration today of Iraqis, maybe mostly Sunnis, but with pictures of Saddam Hussein. What has this guy done? We have a situation now where the most secular country in the Middle East, where the rights of women were most protected, is now in danger of falling into a theocracy. What is called federalism is really a way of taking the oil-rich South and saying you can become like Iran. And the people who are going to be in power there were people who lived in Iran and evidently loved its theocracy and clearly see it as a model. And at the same time, we're saying that we're going to keep this country divided, which is a prescription for civil war going on endlessly, because clearly the Sunnis are not going to accept losing access to the oil. And it's a mess. It's a horrible mess. And to say that the president is exercising leadership when he's floundering is a caricature.
But also there's something very fundamental that the administration is not getting. And It's reflecting the fact that they thought that him, that the president calling the Shiite leader, they thought would help. I mean, they don't get it. They don't get that our very presence there is actually strengthening the insurgency. They don't get it, that him calling is somehow already fueling the whole perception that we are an occupying force and we are actually determining what's going to happen. And all you need to know about what a nightmare the situation is the fact that the deputy prime minister and oil minister is Ahmed Shalabi. I mean, what else do you need to know? This is the guy who lied consistently about weapons of mass destruction, who helped mislead this nation to war, and now he is in this tremendous position of power. And on top of it, the New York Times on Monday had a front page story in which they predicted in the heading that this was all going well. And the main source of the story was Shalabi, who had been their main source in the lousy reporting leading up to the war. I mean, what is going on? Not just in the administration, but in the Times.
I think you actually need to know more than simply that Shalabi is the oil minister, although that's an interesting fact. He gained that position through the politics of post-Saddam Iraq. But it's hardly the beginning and end, the alpha and omega of understanding the attempt to build a country out of the mess of Iraq. Iraq has been a mess since Winston Churchill formed it in 1916. It was only temporarily not a conspicuous mess when Saddam was butchering 1 million people in order, or 300,000 of his own people plus 1 million more in an attempt to ruthlessly hold it like Stalin did Russia. There are, in fact, demonstrations in Russia from time to time with pictures of Stalin. I hope that no one thinks that the world would be better off or Russia would be better off with Stalin ahead. The fact that there are some revanchists in any country looking back to a golden dictatorial age hardly is a reason for those of us who are Democrats with a small d to share that vision.
No, nobody's sharing that vision, Tony.
Oh, I thought somebody
but
was.
No,
sorry.
Nobody was sharing that vision.
I thought somebody was saying that women were better off in Saddam's Iraq than they are today.
Well,
there is no question that
in the current constitution, there is no protection for women's rights because
we don't have a constitution.
We have a draft
it's
of a constitution.
It's being negotiated. It's an ambiguous document. It calls for democratic processes and respect for Islam, and we don't know what that's going to mean in practicality.
And you think ambiguity is going to help women's rights? You have Middle East experts on Meet the Press on Sunday actually saying...
Oh, well, that's it.
Is saying, an AI fellow actually saying that, after all, women's rights are not an essential part of a democracy, quote unquote.
No, I understand. And if we had been sitting around doing punditry on the U.S. Constitution in 1776, we would have said it had deep moral failings. There's no question.
But this is not 1776. It's 2005.
Okay.
And we've spent over $200 billion
I understand. I understand all those facts. I'm just pointing it out.
Matt, this is absurd. If the French had come in to save us from the English and they'd picked their friends to write the Constitution and we were floundering, maybe your analogy would work. But to compare the American Revolution to this caricature...
Did it work in Japan?
To this caricature in Iraq is insulting. But let me address Tony's question because, first of all, the person who embraced Saddam Hussein was our defense secretary. He's the one who went
Let's
over there.
Let's not go back.
No, I will go back. I know you were wrong, Matt, on the war, but that's not the point here. The point is that intervention in both Iran and Iraq, in Iran when we overthrew Mossadegh, our CIA, in Iraq, where, by the way, we were party to putting Hussein in power. Before, this is the man who overthrew Hassan, who was the man who was involved in assassination. He was rewarded by being given this power. My only point was that as bad as it was under Saddam Hussein, there is no question that women were freer in Iraq than just about anywhere else in the Mideast, and that this was
nobody
not a
was free in Iraq.
This was not a theocracy. When it came to the issues of family dispute, the rights of women, the right of women not to have to wear the child or to be able to go to college and so forth, I'm sorry, it's an uncomfortable fact that women in Iraq were freer than they are in Iran. That's the comparison here. And what you have is people now who want to use Iran as the model. And what you're saying is that your intervention in no way has brought some unconscionable forces to power.
Let me make a point. When liberals say that people who live in a slave state, whether it was Soviet...
Bob, let him talk. You're taking up all the time.
whether it was the Soviet Union or Saddam's Iraq, to say that there are relative advantages amongst people who are living under a supreme dictator, I think discredits the concept of freedom. Nobody was free in Saddam. If he gave privileges to this person or that person, it had nothing to do with freedom. It had everything to do with his political calculations.
Okay, but Tony,
when Stalin granted certain privileges to certain people, it is reprehensible, I think, to recognize that period as good in any regard.
Wait a second. Now, first of all, it's nonsense. I don't know what Stalin got into this discussion, but the point is the person who said that Saddam Hussein was relatively better was Donald Rumsfeld. It was the U.S. government. That's why we had an alliance with Saddam Hussein against Iran. And so to say that I'm the one who says Saddam Hussein is better when it was the Republicans.
I don't want us to go to the same.
But that was the whole justification of supporting Iraq against Iran. Now you bring people in who are allied with Iran and you say it's better. And I'm saying it's not demonstrably
better. You guys disagree.
Better.
You disagree. We understand that.
Let the record reflect that when you referred to Rumsfeld, you're talking about the early 1980s when Iran and Iraq was in a war immediately after Iran had taken our hostages. And when you talk about our acting in Iran, it was 1954 under Eisenhower. Most of our listeners were not yet born at that time.
These are not recent
history events.
Right. Two things before we leave Iraq for now. One, Chuck Hagel is making noises that are increasingly independent, and some are even saying he's positioning himself for a potential independent or kind of insurrectionary run on perhaps a critique of the war. Also, E.J. Dionne on Friday had a column very interesting in the Washington Post where one point that a source of his, the Australian former defense minister in Australia, made, which was a concern that Iraq is sucking the oxygen out of American foreign policy. And whatever you think of what got us in there, we're in a situation where the U.S.'s influence and the U.S.'s sort of top management preoccupations are so exclusively Iraq that that's a problem for what ought to be our proper influence in the rest of the world. Go ahead.
There is also something very significant happening in terms of a political realignment because of Chuck Hagel coming out and being so clear and so strong against the war, and especially making the connection between our own safety here at home and how much worse it is because of our invasion of Iraq and what has happened there. So I have heard serious Democrats who are now saying that they are more likely to support Chuck Hagel for president than Hillary Clinton for president. And then, to my surprise, I had Joe Scarborough say on his show this week that he's more likely to support Hillary Clinton than Chuck Hagel. So I believe that the war is going to become the key issue of the 2006 and potentially 2008 election, depending on what has happened, and that it's going to be more important than any other issue in terms of who you vote for. And the lack of leadership and the lack of spine among the Democrats, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, is just truly staggering.
Tony and then Bob briefly, yeah.
Chuck Hagel, who is a friend of mine, we drink at the same coffee shop in suburban Virginia, never really supported the war. Let me finish my thought. His statements are interesting standing alone, but characterizing it as any sort of movement, I think, misperceives his position. As regarding Hillary, I'm going to make a prediction on the show. This is my first public prediction on this, that she and her husband will judge at some point that it is no longer expedient for her to be supporting Bush and will at some point jump to the other side because you're absolutely right that the base of the Democratic Party is so adamantly anti-war that she and her husband will judge that she can't sustain her campaign being supportive of Bush. So my guess is that the moment will come in the next 3 to 8 months when she will switch sides and then become the nominee, much to your regret.
Brief thought on this, Bob, before we break?
So first of all, the interesting thing about Chuck Hagel is that, and it's a position not just accepted by many Democrats now, but polls would indicate 60% of the public is in agreement on this. But Chuck Hagel has gone further in this debate in saying we are part of the problem or a key part of the problem, the point that Ariana was making, that it is our occupation, it is our intervention that, as George Bush's father predicted, our occupation that has turned a very bad situation into something that it's conceivably even worse and a very difficult one to get out of. And the idea that the two of you who supported this war take no responsibility for what has happened means you're not willing to learn the lessons.
Up ahead, Pat Robertson and oil prices, the connection revealed. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center. Robert Scheer is with me on the left. Tony Blankley is in Washington on the right. And Arianna Huffington is also here in Santa Monica and somewhere beyond. Let's move on. Pat Robertson, we're not going to settle all the Iraqi issues on any day. Pat Robertson was in the news this week because he called, I guess very intemperately, for the assassination of the Venezuelan leader, Hugo Chavez. He, in clips I saw at least, said he tried to say that that was taken out of context or it wasn't what he said. But when you look at the clip showing what he did say, that did seem to be what he said. Separately, since there we are trying to have whatever segue we can to oil prices and the energy situation, this does relate to Venezuelan oil. It does relate to oil generally. Tony, is Pat Robertson listened to by anybody? Is it
He's listened to by the mainstream media who have been reporting it with great vigor, and he's listened to by the Venezuelan ambassador who held a press conference that CNN aired live. It's the only, I think, foreign ambassador's press conference that has ever been aired live in this town. Look, he's a nitwit. We're going to start there, and his statements are foolish. Foolish for a number of reasons. First of all, because assassination should never be discussed, whether it is policy or not. And secondly, because the efficacy of presidential assassination by another government is largely proven to be valueless. Churchill, even during World War II, put his thumb in the argument of assassinating Hitler because he understood where it went. Jack Kennedy, who probably either acquiesced or encouraged the assassination of Diem in Vietnam and perhaps Castro in Cuba, and so as conspiratorial theories go, may have got retaliation in his own assassination. If that story is true, that's one of the dangers of getting into the game of assassination. Obviously, if one could have assassinated Hitler in 37, 60 million people wouldn't have died. But I think the argument is pretty powerful not to get into assassination, and he was a fool to talk about it.
Actually,
if we could have taken out Saddam, I think we would have and saved a lot of money.
I don't really think that the point here is discussing the values and virtues of assassination. I think the point here is discussing the role of Pat Robertson in American politics. I mean, it's very well for you to call him a nitwit, but he's one of the nitwits who's met with the President of the United States in the Oval Office, who has had a major role to play in American politics, and this
he
is not
his.
He has
had a major role to play. He's been a gadfly.
You know, how many people does the President of the United States meet with in the Oval Office before the
He's
war?
He's met with me, and I am of no consequence.
Yeah, but come on, Tony, you know what I'm saying. This is not inconsequential. This is
Look,
part
the
of
idea,
the religious right, and you cannot just dismiss it, unfortunately, just because
Robertson,
you happen to be a sane guy as just a nitwit.
Robertson was a losing primary candidate in 1988. Since then, he has had no role in elective politics. Yes, he's a piece of a movement. I concede that. He is not an advisor to the president. His words do not reflect the president's thoughts. And the attempt to connect them, I was on a show the other day on Fox with Jesse Jackson, who said the president needed to apologize for Robertson's statement. I think that's malicious. Robertson is his own man, for better or worse, and the president doesn't need to deal with him any more than Bill Clinton needed to deal with various eccentrics in the Democratic Party in the 90s.
Bob?
Yeah, this is very good news, that Tony, that you feel that Pat Robertson is a nitwit who has no influence. I guess this goes for the Christian Coalition and the forces that he's represented, hopefully Jerry Falwell as well. So maybe we will be returning to him.
No, I didn't say that.
Oh, okay. But anyway, maybe I'm drawing too much optimism from this. But you know, the fact
much
is it would be very good to know that the hold of Pat Robertson and what I thought he represented, a movement that he, in fact, was seemed to be a major leader. the Christian Coalition certainly came out of his inspiration, I think. Anyway, it's good to know that he's now been sidelined and marginalized. But what's lost in all this is, why is Hugo Chavez not Christian? That's the part I don't get. Here's a guy who was in Jamaica at that moment trying to give oil to other countries in Latin America at a reduced price. Here's a guy who was, by the way, democratically elected despite our efforts to overthrow him. I don't know of anything in his social policy that Jesus would object to. And yet no one in the media managed to raise that question. Here's a guy, you could say he's a populist, you could say whatever you want, but here's a guy who has tried to take the oil wealth of a country, which should not have any poor people, by the way, a country run by Standard Oil, American oil companies for most of its existence since it's had oil. Here's a guy who comes along and says, let's use this oil wealth to educate people, to feed them, to give them a decent standard of living, and that's unchristian. That, to my mind, is the startling thing here.
You know what? I really don't think that this should be a debate about the value of assassination or the advantages of the president of Venezuela. I really think this is all about the religious right and Pat Robertson, and this is not the first time that he has made a truly insane statement. I mean, this is the guy, let me remind you, who linked the 9/11 terrorist attacks to feminists and liberals. This is the guy who said that the federal judiciary is a greater threat to America than those who flew the planes to the World Trade Center towers. The list goes on, and the president of the United States met with him after these statements, and you cannot just dismiss it because, Tony, I don't think you have ever made statements like that, so meeting with you is perfectly sane. But meeting with Pat Robertson is an indication of the influence of this movement on this presidency and on American politics, and I'm sorry, it cannot just be dismissed. And I did a LexisNexis search, and so far, unless something happened in the last few hours, James Dobson, Gary Bauer, Jerry Falwell, the Christian Coalition itself has not issued any statement disassociating themselves from Pat Robertson's remarks.
The New York Times said they were too busy to comment. That's what they said.
In fact, I just read an article this morning listing a whole series of Southern Baptists and others.
Minor ones, none of the leaders.
Who were condemning. But for the sake of Christian charity, let me make one statement on behalf of the Reverend Pat Robertson. He did once pray that hurricanes would not knock down his television station, and I believe they were successful prayers.
That's a perfect place to leave it. Let's talk about energy prices, which we haven't addressed a lot, but it's, gas is up at, I forget what the average is now, $2.65 or $2.67 nationally, over $3 in some places. The national bill, this is from Friday's New York Times, on oil is going to go to $600 billion this year, up $210 billion, or 50%, in the last 2 years. This is beginning to ripple to the point where people are concerned about its impact on consumer spending, on economic growth, et cetera, et cetera. And we continue to mull it along after the recent, the last in the series of many energy bills for the last, 25 years since President Carter, that all purport to talk about energy independence and leave us importing several decades after this whole stuff began with the Arab oil embargoes, importing more oil from abroad than ever and seemingly further away from any of the stuff that would actually solve this problem. What is going on and what do we need to do? Go ahead.
That is really the amazing thing. We know exactly what we need to do. We've known it for so many years. I mean, we've known it long before we started the Detroit Project and have been saying for the last 4 years that what we need to do started with fuel efficiency standards for cars and SUVs and being dramatically increased, something which you could have done years and years ago. And here's the administration now introducing some kind of minor increase in fuel efficiency standards, which excludes the largest SUVs and Hummers. This is just like how far we don't get what we need to do in terms of actual policy. And beyond that, renewable energy. And beyond that, conservation, which the Vice President of the United States called a private virtue in a dismissive way. All those things we've known for years we should be doing, we're still not doing them, even with what's happening, because of the tremendous power of the auto industry lobby and all the oil industry lobby and all those who are determined to take no steps in terms of improving the situation.
And yet, if Tony, I want to get you into this, but if gas prices stay this high or go higher, as some analysts predict, if oil continues to go higher, you'd think that this would spur the kind of market response as well in terms of what cars get built here that I've always thought higher gas taxes should and ought to have spurred. Where are you on all this?
Well, the most predictable economic consequence of the current high prices for oil is and it's beginning, but it'll be about a 2 or 3 year lag, is more money is going to be put in by oil companies to bring up oil from the ground that was not worth bringing up at $30 or $40 a barrel, but will be worth bringing up at $50 or $60. The interesting economic fact, of course, and has been well noted, and we editorialized on it ourselves a few times recently, is the surprising fact that the economy continues to move along pretty adequately, not perfectly, but adequately, in the face of this rise in oil prices, that certainly 15, 20 years ago, when energy energy was a bigger component of American economic activity, this would have been a real body blow to our economy. And this time, it is not a body blow to the economy. It is a body blow to the pocketbook of people who have to buy gasoline. And to be whimsical for just a moment, this obviously is a call for coal-powered cars because coal is the cheapest energy available, and we have 700 years' supply. But that's just a joke.
You know, one thought before I give it to you, Bob, is that the Washington Post did have some interesting facts. These are not bawdy limericks, by the way, but some facts about the relative cost of a gallon of Starbucks coffee is $14.96 a gallon. Milk, at least in the Washington area, whole milk, $3.39 a gallon. Gas prices approaching milk. Jack Daniel's whiskey, $316 per gallon. So, and a six pack.
But you can go further with a gallon of whiskey than you can with the mouth.
And a six pack of Budweiser is $9.65 a gallon, and a gallon of water, you know, the kind of bottled Aquafina, $7.36. So, Bob, what are we complaining about?
Well, I suspect voters might have a different economic interest than we do, and these increase in the price of gas might affect them more seriously, and it might affect how they vote the next time. I do want to make two observations here. One is that imperialism doesn't pay. We were led to believe with a big wink-wink that somehow grabbing the second largest supply of oil in the world would pay off. It would pay for our war, which it hasn't. It's draining our treasury. It would create a more stable supply of oil. There's less oil being pumped from Iraq now than there was before the invasion. So what the Chinese have shown is you're going to have to buy this stuff. It's better than owning it. The other thing I would point out is that the best conservation measure is for the price to go up. And what we need to do is punish those who buy these Hummers like our governor and celebrate them one way or another, either with an extra tax or shift the burden to them rather than the people who have to drive to work.
We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Just about 15 seconds each. Tony Blankley, it's your soapbox.
Once again, not a peeve, but London Zoo has unveiled a new exhibit, 8 humans prowling around wearing little more than fig leaves, recognizing that humans are just animals too. I wish I could fly over there and see the exhibit. I think that's a fair representation of evolution.
Arianna Huffington.
In his Eat the Press column on the Huffington Post, Harry Shearer has a brilliant audio of Pat Robertson deciding who else should be assassinated, and I highly recommend that you read it. It ends with the invocation to prayer.
10 seconds, Bob.
Yes, this week the Federal Communications Commission finally reversed its stupid policy of allowing phone companies to just waste our phone numbers, waste area codes, and so once again we can say we don't need to do any overlay of phone numbers, we don't need to split any further, but the California Public Utilities Commission chose to ignore the FCC and, in effect, end area codes and force us all to dial 11 digits.
Great moments in sport. Donald Trump's wife, Melanie Kaus, recently found herself addressing an NYU business school class. They said to her, if her husband weren't rich, would she still be with him? Her response, without skipping a beat, if I weren't beautiful, do you think he'd be with me? That's all the retorts we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Bob Scheer, Arianna Huffington, and Tony Blankley. Sarah Spitz produced today's program. Our technical director is Ray Guarna. I'm Matt Miller. Tune in next for more Left, Right, and Center.
I wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
But we know we need each other, so we better call the building up.
Audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.